Hello and welcome to the Politics Home podcast. I'm Matt Honeycomb-Foster, still the acting editor here at Politics Home. A hard rain is going to fall on the civil service. Not my words, but the words of Dominic Cummings, the Prime Minister's top advisor, as he promised a major shake-up of the way that the civil service does its job in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic. We've already seen what looks like the first big Whitehall scalp of that promised revolution, with Sir Mark Sedwill, the UK's top civil servant, throwing in the towel this weekend. So who exactly is Sedwill? What's Dominic Cummings got planned? And why does any of this actually matter? On the latest podcast today, I'll be joined by three people who know their Whitehall onions. We've got Richard Johnston, Deputy Editor of Civil Service World, who spends his life thinking about and reporting on Whitehall. Catherine Haddon, Senior Fellow at the Institute for Government Think Tank, who can put a bit of context on all of this. And Dave Penman, General Secretary of the FDA Union, which is not exactly happy with the way Sedwill's departure has been handled. I started off by asking Richard who on earth Mark Sedwill is.
So Mark Sedwill has been Cabinet Secretary, which is the government's top civil servant, since October 2018. He took over the role from Sir Jeremy Hayward when Hayward became ill and was being treated back for cancer, and then took the role on permanently when Hayward had to retire, which sadly just before he died. He was quite an unusual pick to be CabSec. He came from a security and diplomatic policy background rather than economic and domestic policy roles, which tend to be the hinterland of most people who ended up cabinet secretary, most men who ended up as cabinet secretary, because they have all been men. But he served as Home Office PermSec under Theresa May, and they had a strong relationship. So when there was a need for an acting cabinet secretary, he was brought in from his role as National Security Advisor, which he also continued to hold when May was PM. And yeah, since then, he's been at the top of government through Brexit, through the transfer of power from May to Boris Johnson, and now, of course, at the coronavirus pandemic.
So how was his departure announced? How did all this come out, Richard?
So it was announced rather unexpectedly, rather unusually, on a Sunday evening by government. It had been briefed to the Sunday Telegraph that his departure was imminent, and I think there was some reports earlier in the week in the Financial Times as well, but it all then came out very quickly. It was an exchange of letters between him and the Prime Minister last night, confirming that he would depart. He's written, so Mark, to civil servants today on Monday, saying it was the right time for him to step down as we've come to the end of the acute phase of the COVID-19 crisis, and the government's focus switches to domestic policy and global recovery and renewal. And as part of that, he said that the Prime Minister wants a separate national security advisor to support him on that global part of that agenda, and the Cabinet Secretary and head of the civil service to focus domestically. So one of the replacements in those jobs, the National Security Advisor role, has already been filled. David Frost, who's currently the Prime Minister's chief negotiator in the trade talks with the EU, will take over. He's slightly unusual as a pick for that job as well. He doesn't have the defence and security experience that Sedwill did, for example, when he took it over. But it also turns a civil service role into a politically appointed one, which I think is causing a little bit of unease amongst some in government. Lord Gus O'Donnell, his former cabinet secretary, said it worries him that becomes a politically appointed role. That's quite a major shift that happened again yesterday evening in these series of announcements.
So obviously, you know, officials in Whitehall move in and out of government all the time. Why does this one matter, and what can we read into it?
I think it matters for two reasons. One is just it's a huge change at the heart of government at the time of national crisis. The cabinet secretary is the top official in government who plays a key role behind the scenes trying to, you know, unblock problems and join up different parts of Whitehall. And the person who will replace Mark said, well, we'll be new to that role in September when hopefully we'll be well clear of COVID-19, but we might not be. And there could be a second outbreak. There could be localized outbreaks that the government will need to respond to. And the new person in the job would have quite a learning curve to get used to. And I think it also matters because it looks like it's part of an increasing politicisation of the civil service. Sedwell's letter to the Prime Minister said that he and Johnson had agreed I will stand down. So it sounds like one of those mutual breakups that's much more mutual on one side than the other. And coupled with a Frost appointment, it begins to look like we're moving in a direction where prime ministers get to choose their own cabinet secretaries and top officials to match their own ambitions and plans. And once you do that, the argument goes you get less forthright advice as officials will become reluctant to present uncomfortable truths, both to ministers, but to their superiors too, if they're politically appointed.
Have we seen any other significant departures at the top of Whitehall in recent months, Richard?
Yeah, there's been quite a lot of change in the senior jobs in government. The one that hit the headlines was Philip Rutnam leaving the Home Office in a dispute with Priti Patel over bullying allegations that Priti Patel had faced in the department, and quite a lot of briefing about Sir Philip's role in the department and his competence, and that got quite uncomfortable, I think, and is going to be settled possibly in an employment tribunal. There's also been a number of other civil service permanent secretary moves. The head of the Department for International Development moved, Matthew Rycroft moved to replace Rutnam at the Home Office. The head of the Department for Business moved to the Cabinet Office. So there's been quite a lot of churn at the top of Whitehall, and that creates a bit of an interesting question when you look at the possible contenders to take over as Cabinet Secretary, because a lot of people have just moved jobs. We'll have more people moving to replace Sir Simon MacDonald at the top of the Foreign Office, and Bayes still needs a new Perm Sec as well. So there's a lot of churn, and makes you wonder who will get the top job now it's free.
And finally, is it too simplistic to read this move as the start of the Dominic Cummings revolution in Whitehall?
No, I don't think it is. Dominic Cummings has a long-standing plan and wish to reform the civil service. He's previously argued that the idea of a permanent civil service is an idea for the history books, and he's talked about breaking up the role of permanent secretaries in departments between their managerial responsibilities and their policy responsibilities. And I think you can see the appointment of David Frost kind of fitting quite neatly into that worldview. We got a hint at the weekend in a speech that Michael Gove gave about where they want to go next, about decentralization, about bringing different people in to the civil service with additional expertise. We have Dominic Cummings' own call for weirdos and misfits to join him working in government from earlier this year. And I think we'll probably hear quite a lot more soon about some of his plans for reforms that, as I said, Alex Chisholm has been tasked with developing civil service reform plans in the Cabinet Office. The key thing, I think, is the next CabSec will know that Cummings and Johnson want reform. I don't really think it's fair to characterise Sir Mark Sedwell as some sort of roadblock, but I wasn't expecting a wide-ranging reform of Whitehall led by the Prime Minister's closest advisor when he took on the job. His successor will have a much clearer idea of what they're in for, and I think that probably changes how you interact with the Whitehall machine and what levers you pull and buttons you push to try and get those changes.
All prime ministers tend to want to put their mark on the machinery of government, and some are more successful than others. The Institute for Government is a think tank that spent a lot of time looking at what does and doesn't work in Whitehall and coming up with recommendations for how things might be improved. Catherine Haddon is a senior fellow at the IFG, and I started off by asking her how Sir Mark's tenure as Cabinet Secretary compared to his predecessors.
Well, I mean, the first thing to say is that the circumstances in which he took over were extraordinary and very tragic. You had the, you know, severe illness and then death of the previous cabinet secretary. And so Mark said, well, initially as an acting cabinet secretary, perhaps didn't even think that he would stay on in the job permanently, but was encouraged to do so by the then Prime Minister, Theresa May. So in some respects, he's the most reluctant of cabinet secretaries that we've had in the history of the role. And perhaps, therefore, it's not surprising that he didn't stay as long. But obviously, we can't get away from the fact that, you know, he has, to all extents and purposes, been pushed out by what has been some quite extreme briefing against him.
Now, Seddle was unusual in that he did really three roles, didn't he? Can you talk me through what those roles were and perhaps sort of shed some light on how unusual that mix of jobs is?
Yeah, so the cabinet secretary role in itself is, you know, the fulcrum of cabinet government. Officially, they are the person who helps the prime minister manage the business of government, preparing the agenda and so forth. But the reality is their job is a lot behind the scenes, fixing problems, right arounds between departments when there's clashes between departments, and also advising the prime minister on all matters, whether to do with policy or to do with the constitution or how the prime minister might go about fixing the problems of government. So they have a very big role there. For many years, the role has been combined with head of the civil service, certainly through most of the post-war period, with a couple of moments where it was split off, one of which was quite recently under the first part of Jeremy Hayward's time as cabinet secretary. But they combined it again. And the reason is that role, it's not really a chief executive role, but it is a very important leadership role. And it brings with it a lot of levers, both in terms of management of other permanent secretaries, but also kind of being able to be a champion of the civil service as a whole. So the roles go very well together, even though they're sort of slightly different in terms of their focus. What Mark Sedwell brought with him was also the role of National Security Advisor. And throughout his time in the post, it's been said he should have let that go and let somebody focus on that wholly. If you actually go back to the period before sort of 9/11, most cabinet secretaries had quite a strong flavour of both intelligence, i.e. the work of the intelligence agencies, and also national security, whether it was sort of defence, nuclear war planning during the Cold War, or, you know, possible terrorism and so forth. And they would always play a role in aspects of that with other advisors there for the Prime Minister. But the NSA role was created to give it extra clout and to make sure that a much larger machinery at the centre on national security had a single person focusing on it. So the argument is that he has neglected either one or the other of the roles, depending on which issue comes up. He's always argued that it plays to his strengths and that he's able to combine it deputising. But obviously, this was one of the factors in why they wanted to look for, you know, a new person to head up the NSA role and it not be the same as the cabinet secretary.
Now, of course, stepping into that national security role now will be David Frost, the Prime Minister's chief Europe advisor and the lead negotiator for the post-Brexit future relationship talks. How significant is it that Frost is a political appointment rather than a civil service one in this job?
I mean, it's very significant in terms of how the role's going to be worked. It was, you know, even before David Cameron took office, he made the decision that the NSA would be an official and not a political appointment, though they were considering having a political appointment in that role. They were, even at that time, kind of seduced by the American style NSA approach. But here there's somebody who heads up a machinery, a secretariat, who sits at the sort of fulcrum of national security machinery across Whitehall. So not having an official will have some, because unless they change the rules, he's not able to order civil servants around. So they will have to be managed elsewhere. He does have a lot of deputies who do a lot of the detailed work, but nonetheless, you know, his ability to interact with the civil servants, the way in which they're managed, and also his understanding of the whole of the brief, because he comes with a lot of foreign policy experience, but not necessarily a security and intelligence background. So that's all going to be put into question. But it's worth saying, I mean, you know, this is how Boris Johnson now envisages the role. The previous version was created by David Cameron. It was how he saw the role. But if you go back to Thatcher's time, she had the advisors that she wanted and trusted in place, and she hung on to them despite people trying to say that she should actually put new people into those posts and that she was in danger of politicizing the role. But she wanted to stick to the people that she trusted. So in that sense, Johnson is doing what, you know, many prime ministers do in terms of the people closest to him.
So we shouldn't be overly surprised perhaps by the prime minister wanting to shape the machinery of government around him and his kind of governing style and program.
No, not at all. But I think the question then you have to ask is, what impact is this going to have? One of the reasons why the National Security Council and the beefed up secretariat was created was that they felt you needed a much greater coordination, because national security issues are covered by a whole host of different departments. You know, in some respects, all departments have some kind of bearing on it, but whether it's, you know, the Foreign Office, Ministry of Defence, Home Office, International Development, you know, they're all doing aspects of this. And one of the issues before 2010 was the danger of not having proper coordination at the top, and also having a prime ministerial led committee that would look at issues, you know, in depth, strategically, as well as sort of short term urgent issues. And the danger is that they lose some of that. And if so, have to think through what the consequences are going to be in terms of our preparedness for all sorts of issues. And obviously we've seen with COVID the danger of not being prepared for stuff.
Now, also this weekend, and it sort of flew under the radar a little bit, but Michael Gove, the Cabinet Office Minister, gave a very, what seemed like a very significant speech on how he believes the structure of government and the way Whitehall works needs to change. What did we learn from it, Kath?
Well, some of it wasn't wholly new, neither wholly new in terms of this government's interests in terms of civil service reform and what it wants how it wants the government to change. We've seen quite a bit of that before in terms of both a blog post by Dominic Cummings, but also some briefings to the media. What was significant was obviously seeing it in one place and coming from a speech by a minister who is able to enact such changes, because as the person in charge of the Cabinet Office, a lot of this agenda will sit with Michael Gove. But it also wasn't that new in terms of a lot of the detail of it, or rather a lot of the themes of it weren't that new in civil service reform circles, you know, talking about the need for people to stay longer in post and to make sure that institutional memory and deep policy expertise was not lost. I mean, the IFG has been writing reports about that for a long while. Same in terms of issues about getting greater diversity of thinking into government, better skills, whether it's sort of statistics or finance skills. You know, these are all themes that people have been talking about for a long while. I think, you know, it was very significant in terms of having this come from Michael Gove, seeing it in one place and seeing the kind of thinking behind it, his rationale for a lot of it. What the big question is, though, is how they're going to go about reforming this. They've got a new chief operating officer, Alex Chisholm, in place, so a senior civil servant whose agenda this will be. And they will also have a new cabinet secretary sometime in the next couple of months. But the big question is how you're going to go about doing this, because it took David Cameron's government under Francis Maude, who was then the minister in charge, it took him about 2 years before he came up with a blueprint for actually implementing any of this stuff. And that's really where you start to get into the question about whether or not any of this is likely.
As you touched on there, there was a sort of big push under the coalition government that Michael Gove, of course, was a part of to reform Whitehall and reform the civil service. Did any of those initiatives kind of stick? And perhaps, you know, where do you think the civil service could still improve what it does? What recommendations have you guys been pushing for a while on changing things?
Yeah, so the big thing that stuck, it wasn't wholly new for the coalition government, but it was a focus on what was called the professional skills agenda, which is basically a way of saying that you need sort of more cadres of people who come in with proper qualifications and skills in particular areas. I mean, if you go back to the 1950s and 60s, they were talking about this in terms of economics and statistics. More latterly, it was things like commercial skills, digital skills, you know, the ability to be able to make good contracts, to get better IT systems, and more diversity in how you're using digital tools, basically, across Whitehall. So there has been a lot of success in that, in terms of both getting more people in with those skills and also making them more prominent and in key jobs across Whitehall. So that's been wholly successful, or rather, that's been, you know, largely successful. Still a lot, long way to go. Michael Gove, though, was talking more about people who are what, you know, is often called the policy profession, the people who perhaps at the top of the organisation are thinking through policies and sort of reacting to them, assessing them, putting new ideas to ministers, and whether or not they also need an improvement of skills to make sure that they understand the sort of research, best use of evidence, you know, different tools, statistics, whatever it might be that they can bring to bear on policy making. Where some of this stuff ends up falling down, though, or where, you know, certainly the last government, the coalition government, struggled with some of this stuff is particularly the issue of turnover of staff. And that just seemed to keep going upwards. We've talked about that quite a lot. It's issues to do with pay and performance, how people are rewarded. But it's also, to be honest, a lot to do with the leadership, both in the civil service and of ministers, and the kind of signals they send out to people throughout the civil service of what you get rewarded for doing. And you get rewarded for doing big jobs and moving on to the next big job. And what you need to do is a lot more work to make sure you're rewarding people for staying, and make sure that the kind of pay structure isn't such that you can only get any kind of pay rise by moving departments or moving job. And that's the key thing that this government needs to change. But we do have a good report for them to look at of how to do that.
Now, the FDA trade union has been sharply critical of the way the departure of Mark Sedwill was handled. They see it as part of a pattern of hostile briefings against senior officials who might not be on the same page ideologically with the current number 10 team. Dave Penman is the General Secretary of the FDA, and I started off by asking him how this resignation would go down with his members.
Well, I mean, I think that they're quite astonished, not just around how events unfolded yesterday on a Sunday as they did in quite extraordinary circumstances, but this has actually been about the kind of briefing war against the Cabinet Secretary and leadership in the civil service over many months, indeed years, and it's kind of culminated in this tumultuous event yesterday. So not only is there concern about so Mark essentially being driven out, because that's certainly what it looks like, they're also concerned, I think, about the approach of this government, where the tactics that are being used to undermine the senior leadership, the civil service, the anonymous briefings that are clearly sourced around number 10, just create a really kind of toxic and corrosive atmosphere at the top of the civil service, and that permeates down. And it's the last thing we need, to be honest, facing a kind of national emergency around health, around the economy, running up to the negotiations and more formal exit around the trade agreements with the European Union, or indeed even just trying to deliver on the government's agenda of kind of levelling up, as they keep referencing. So it's really kind of counterproductive, it's destructive in terms of morale in the civil service, and it's just no way to run a government.
Of course, it's not unusual for a prime minister to kind of come in and want to reshape his top team and change the way government does things. Is your criticism of the FDA really focused on the manner in which this was handled rather than the fact that the PM's done what he's done?
Yeah, I mean, you don't get to the top of the civil service without recognising that the relationship between whether it's a permanent secretary and a minister or the cabinet secretary and the prime minister is critical. You know, and part of the job of a civil servant is to make that work. You know, they can't guarantee always to get on with the minister that they're dealing with, but their job is to support and give the advice and support that ministers and prime ministers need. So, you know, that sometimes doesn't work out. And if the prime minister, having to some degree inherited as coming in and there was already a cabinet secretary in post, found that for whatever reason, you know, that wasn't working, then civil servants are grown up enough to understand that has to be addressed, it can't go on, and if it's fundamental, then something needs to change. But it's the manner that this is done with. You know, it's done like a war. It's done where it's briefing and it's trying to undermine people. It's trying to apportion blame. You know, Mark Sebo's, you know, over various months or nearly 2 years has been attacked, you know, as a Remainer when he was given advice about exiting the European Union, a blocker to reform, apparently. You know, the latest briefings around where responsibility lies for failings around COVID-19. He was criticised for being the National Security Advisor and the Cabinet Secretary. So that kind of approach to stuff, rather than actually dealing with as a set of grown-ups and recognising if change needs to be done, it needs to be managed, is where we really kind of fall and say that's just not good for government if you do that. You know, no private sector organisation would do that. No chairman of a private company would undermine their chief executive publicly and expect, essentially, for that company to thrive. So things have got to be done differently. Otherwise, it's going to have a serious impact on the civil service's morale and ability to deliver.
Now, the government's obviously come in for criticism on a number of fronts during the COVID-19 pandemic. What would you say to people in the Conservative Party and in Number 10 who look at the handling of this crisis and say, look, something has to change in the way we run the country, the structures and institutions we use to get stuff done?
Well, I mean, I think the starting point has to look at it and say, how healthy is our civil service? Every government wants to reform. This government, in one guise or another, has been here for 10 years, remember. So there's been lots of reform. The civil service, the UK civil service, is currently ranked number one in the world around its efficiency and effectiveness in an international and independent kind of global ranking. So it's not to say everything's perfect, but it's to say there's an awful lot that's going well. So inevitably, that, you know, something like the COVID-19 pandemic throws up new challenges, some of which may be foreseen, some of which may not, and some of which will be handled well, some won't. If you look at how the civil service has responded to dealing with some of the aspects of it, like the surge in claims, a sixfold increase in the claims for universal credit, introducing the furlough scheme where 9 million workers are dependent upon subsidy that was designed by a department and delivered by a department where 90% of the staff were having to work from home. So it had to reorganise itself overnight as well as then invent and deliver this new system. There are lots of things that go right. So there is always a challenge of reform. There is always, when something big happens, trying to look and see what has gone wrong. Does that responsibility lie with ministers? Does it lie with civil servants as individuals, as structures? Clearly, that has to happen. And civil servants do this as their day-to-day job. If you talk to any civil servant, they'll talk about that continual process of reform and analysis that goes on as part of their day job. But it's how you go about that. Are you doing that to the civil service, or are you doing it with them? You know, the Prime Minister is the head of the civil service. He's the Minister for the Civil Service. His job is to inspire and challenge the civil service. It's not to blame and it's not to undermine. And if you really want the sort of change that this government says they want, then you need to take hundreds of thousands of civil servants and the thousands of leaders out there with you. That's not the way to do it. You know, briefing, trying to destroy careers and livelihoods when people disagree with you is not the way to inspire a generation of civil servants.
Well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for on the latest Politics Home podcast. Thanks very much to my guests today. They were Dave Penman of the FDA Trade Union, Kath Haddon of the Institute for Government, and Richard Johnston of Civil Service World. You can keep up to date with absolutely everything going on in politics by going to politicshome.com. Next time, we'll be taking a look at the government's plans for a big immigration shake-up, that Australian-style points-based system we keep hearing about. What is it? What's it going to mean? And how has it been changed by the COVID-19 pandemic? We'll be taking a look at all of that next time. But until then, stay safe and thank you very much for listening.